Illinois has 215 new laws that reach every part of our lives. Here's the BGA's Jose Sanchez Molina explaining one law that makes it harder to expel kids from preschool.
The data has shown that once a student is expelled, suspended from school, they're more likely to interact with the justice system and then get caught up in the school-to-prison pipeline.
And as more people seek help for drug addiction, what are the most important things you need to know about finding the right treatment facility? Also, the Golden Globes is this weekend, the award for best TV drama of the year. According to the AV Club's Eric Adams, we'll go to a show that's
taking a gimlet eye to the way that things are happening in America. I think that may curry favor with the voters of the HFPA, in addition to being just a very solid drama.
We'll find out his prediction. Stay tuned. That's all ahead this hour on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A new year means new laws going into effect. In our case for Illinois, that covers everything from new trauma training for police officers to tax credits for private school scholarships to a ban on circus elephants. In all, 215 new laws. Thankfully, we have a few folks throughout the state who are up to speed on what's being implemented. Sophia Tureen covers state and city politics for the Associated Press, and Jose Sanchez Molina is a policy analyst with the Better Government Association. Both of them are joining us now from Chicago. Sophia, Jose, welcome to the 21st. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Happy New Year. Thank you.
Sophia, let's start with you. We're going to go through several new laws, but I think probably the one that got the most attention and one of the most controversial pieces of legislation signed last year was HB 40. That's been the subject of the lawsuit. Governor Rauner took a lot of heat from some conservative groups because it deals with abortion. Can you explain what that covers as this law goes into effect this week?
Yeah, absolutely. So Governor Rauner surprised a lot of people last year when he kind of reversed course and signed a law that will allow state health insurance and Medicaid coverage for abortions. The law also does something else where it makes sure that abortions remain legal in Illinois by removing language in state statute that could criminalize abortion if there's anything ever happens to a 1973 U.S. court. U.S. Supreme Court ruling that legalizes the procedure if it's ever overturned or anything like that. And so because of Rauner's support of that, he's now facing a primary challenger. He's angered many conservatives. There's about two dozen or so lawmakers and conservative and Christian groups that filed a lawsuit. And they sought a preliminary injunction to block when the law could take effect. And they're kind of arguing some technical terms, saying, it was too late, approved too late by lawmakers, so it shouldn't take effect immediately, and they're trying to stop it. That initial lawsuit was dismissed. The judge said he doesn't think that the courts should get involved in essentially political questions involving the General Assembly. But those groups then followed up with an appeal this week, and they're saying they still have time. I mean, technically the law did take effect on January 1st, but it was a holiday, and the groups involved with the lawsuit, like Thomas Memorial Society, a bunch of roughly a dozen lawmakers, they're saying that the law really doesn't take effect in earnest for a few months, just because the way that the state reimburses for medical procedures, it could be until April, until actually the first money goes out. So they're hoping to get an appeal and, have that heard in court.
Yeah, so that's actually a law that's still some questions about, depending on this lawsuit, Sophia, I guess, in terms of how this law will play out. Jose, I wonder if we can talk criminal justice for a minute. The Illinois Police Training Act was amended and now taking effect will include trauma training. What is this? How will this change training for police officers?
Yeah, so what this new law is going to do is it's going to make it so that when police are trained, they also include training on how to recognize and respond to stress, trauma, and any sort of post-traumatic stress that comes from just being an officer. And what that's going to allow to do is it's going to allow officers to recognize some of that in some of their peers. And what we're hoping is that it leads to better policing. Some of the data has pointed that some of the officers that are kind of caught up in some of the cases that we hear about where they kind of abuse their power are actually some of the officers that prior to those incidents experienced a lot of stress. And so we feel like this is just good policing and it's something that's going to help people.
And there's also some cyberbullying laws that will be changed, Jose. What is that about?
Yeah, cyberbullying, it's going to increase the penalty. So before, the penalty wasn't as harsh, but now intimidating somebody, stalking somebody, or even just sending somebody obscene messages could be prosecuted as a hate crime and felony. And it also includes a penalty of up to $1,000 for hate crimes. So I think just making sure that people are aware that this is something serious now and you can get in big trouble for doing it.
This first week of 2018, we're talking about new laws that go into effect for Illinois. We were just discussing abortion, criminal justice. Let's talk education. Sophia, This year, the lawmakers' big overhaul of the way public schools are being funded will go into effect. And part of that is that last-minute addition that happened at the end of school funding reform last year of a $75 million tax credit for private school scholarships. In fact, Governor Rauner was already this week talking about how much money has been raised. Can you explain how that's going to work, Sophia?
Yeah. So basically, this was, like you said, a last-minute addition as part of this historic school funding reform. And for a lot of people, it kind of came out of nowhere. And one of the big proponents of it was the Chicago Cardinal, Blaise Cupich, and other private school and Catholic school officials. And basically, it's a five-year pilot program that lets people and companies get a tax credit worth 75% of their donation, so and up to about $1 million. They can give to a specific school, but not to a specific student. And students who qualify for those basically have to meet some federal poverty guidelines, roughly an income of $73,000 for about a family of four. The use of tax credits is kind of, it falls under what they call school choice models, something like vouchers, education savings accounts, very popular in Republican-led states. And it was fought by teachers unions and school officials who said, you know, that taxpayer money shouldn't be used to fund private schools. They fear that, you know, some of the public schools could lose enrollment, particularly in areas like Peoria, Rockford, Chicago, whereas you have proponents saying, you know, this is just another option for parents. And so this week, there's a couple of key things that happened this week. One is that the governor's office announced that they've already had $36 million from taxpayers pledging to, you know, to give for these scholarships. And later this month, I believe starting January 24th, students can start applying for these scholarships.
Okay. And so that's for tax credits for private school scholarships. Jose, there were also some changes to whether or not preschoolers can be expelled from school. Was that a problem?
Yeah. So this is a pretty important solution, I think, an issue that we often don't talk about. So this new law is going to require that any early childhood program, before they expel a preschooler, have to use every service at their disposal to deal with whatever the issue is. And then if they do expel them, they have to make sure that they kind of create a plan in order for them to transition into another program, or just give them something to do that's not going to be in the preschool program. The reason that this is so important is because the data has shown that once a student is expelled, suspended from school, they're more likely to interact with the justice system and then get caught up in the school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And there's already an existing law for first graders all the way through high school. This is just kind of extending it into preschool. So I think it's a common sense solution, and it's dealing with an important issue.
Well, we're talking about younger children, Jose. There's also a daycare database that's supposed to be developed by DCFS. What will that contain?
Yeah, so it's just going to be a database that people are going to be able to access through DCFS's website. And they're just going to get information on different daycares, it's going to include reports on child abuse, and then also any information related to the license. So they'll be able to see if the daycare has an up-to-date license, or when was the last time that the license was renewed.
That's Jose Sanchez Molina. He's a policy analyst with the Better Government Association. We're talking to him and the Associated Press's Sophia Turin about Illinois' 215 new laws that took effect this week. Moving on to LGBTQ issues, Sophia, you did some reporting as well on a new law that will make Illinois the second state after California to outlaw the so-called gay panic defense in criminal proceedings. What's that?
Yeah, so it's not a very common defense. It's basically, you know, when a person commits a crime and can use the victim's sexual orientation as a reason or a motivating factor. The way, you know, it's explained to me is if, you know, for example, somebody engages in a flirtation with someone and then realizes, you know, that they're transgender, or then finds out their sexual orientation and then basically has such a passionate response that it could end up in a serious crime. And it's not something that is also that clearly defined. You know, I spoke with a lot of defense attorneys who say, well, that on its own would never hold up in court. But it's been used kind of in conjunction with insanity or self-defense claims. And one of the cases that a lot of the advocates point to is the killing of a transgender woman in New York in 2013. And a very similar situation, a man engaged in a flirtation with the woman and didn't realize that she was transgender, then did and, you know, punched her, admitted to doing so, and she fell and she died. And he was sentenced in 2016 to 12 years in a plea deal, which a lot of, you know, experts say is quite lenient. So what this does is, I mean, specifically it talks about not being able to use this defense in, you know, trying to get a lesser sentence or as a provocation of second degree murder. But essentially it's a ban for using it in the state. And the thing that was surprising about Illinois was that there was no opposition to it in the legislature. Nobody voted against it, and the Republican governor signed it. So a lot of the LGBTQ advocates are saying they're going to try to replicate that model in 7 states this year.
The actual language of it, I guess it sounds like, right, Sophia? Mm-hmm.
The language and the language and the tactic and the momentum that, hey, a Republican governor signed this in Illinois, you know, let's see where else we can make inroads. And one of them, you know, they've had legislation in New Jersey and Washington State, also those proposals that didn't really go over anywhere. They're going to revive those as well as, you know, several other state houses, including in Texas.
So it's possible that Illinois' model could be used in other states. One thing that Illinois is known for that is not a good thing is how many units of government we have. Jose, this is an issue that the Better Government Association has advocated for to reduce the number of units of government. It sounds kind of wonky. Why does this matter? What did the new laws do?
Yeah, so a lot of people don't know that the reason their property tax bill is so high is there's just so many units of government that we have to pay for. You know, sometimes if you live in a specific suburb, for example, you might have a mosquito district for your township, then for your county, and then for the suburb that you're living in. With this new law, it's a law that advocates have really fought for a number of years now. It's going to expand the ability for voters to begin dissolving those units in order for services to be delivered a little more efficiently and for taxpayers to be able to save a little money on their property tax bill. And again, I think it's really important to stress that, you know, this is something that really empowers voters and doesn't mandate that units be dissolved, but just gives them the ability to begin doing so.
In politics, also, Sophia, Obama Day begins this year on August 4th. But Sophia, this isn't an official state holiday?
No, it's not. The lawmakers did try to make it an official state holiday, but there was a lot of discussion about whether a state that has as many financial problems as Illinois does could afford to give, you know, state employees another paid day off. So they basically kind of toned it back to just a day that kind of commemorates him and, you know, specifically notes the way he built bridges in you know, among different communities. And that's in the law. So it's more of a commemoration day to honor the former president, but not an official holiday.
And I mentioned at the beginning, Sophia, there's a ban on circus elephants. Is Illinois actually, according to your reporting, the first state to do this?
Yeah. Yes, it is. There's actually been some concern from animal rights activists for years about the treatment of using live elephants in traveling shows, circuses, you know, any kind of a display show that where elephants are featured. And it's actually kind of been going out of fashion. In 2016, you know, the biggest, most famous circus, the Ringling Brothers, they retired all their live elephants to a conservatory, I think, in Florida. So some of those advocates made an appeal to people in Illinois, and Illinois was the first state to do this ban. And then that law was signed in August. And then a couple of months later, New York actually did a similar ban. And now there's legislation that's emerging in a couple of other states, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Washington. And it doesn't apply to zoos.
Right. So, it's just for performing elephants, I guess, would be the distinction.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
Well, that's just there's 215 new laws that have taken effect this week in Illinois. That's a brief description of some of them, from education to criminal justice, as we talked about all of these things. Sophia and Jose both have some more pieces that they've written that detail a little bit more of these laws that we didn't have a chance to get into. So we'll tweet out their stories that they did. I want to thank Sophia Turin with the Associated Press, Jose Sanchez Molina. He's a policy analyst with the Better Government Association. Sophia covers state and city politics for the AP. Both of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The numbers for 2017 aren't out yet, but we already know that the number of Americans who have been dying from drug overdoses is on the rise. That's because in 2016, that number was 64,000. That's 22% more than the year before, according to the New York Times. As you're probably aware of, opioids are a big reason that the number of total drug overdoses are growing. Here in Illinois, nearly 1,900 people died from opioid overdoses in 2016. We've talked about this crisis on the 21st before, and today we wanted to ask a simple question. What makes for good addiction treatment? And if you're trying to find effective and affordable treatment, whether that's for yourself or for a loved one, what should you look for? And should you be careful about being scammed during this process? Joining us now to help answer these questions is Sarah Howe. She's the CEO of the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. Sarah, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us as well from Chicago's Department of Public Health is Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury-Afshar. She's the Medical Director of Behavioral Health. Dr. Salisbury-Afshar, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me as well.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Sarah, can I start with you? And if we can we start big picture? If you're someone who's looking for drug addiction treatments, whether it's for opioids or another addiction, I imagine these days most people are talking about opioid addiction. What are some of the most important qualities people should be looking for in providers?
Sure. Well, there are a few things you definitely want to be able to do. Starting at the basic, you want to be able to talk to that provider agency directly. And I know that sounds something really obvious. But what we've seen right now is that there are a lot of hotlines that have popped up. There are a lot of middle brokers that are in between the actual agency and the patient themselves, and you don't often have the opportunity to speak directly to that provider. So the first thing I would say when you're looking is, do you have a number for the agency on their website? Can you find where they are? Are you able to pick up the phone? Are you able to ask them what kind of services they provide? What levels of care do they provide? How involved is the family? What are their expectations? Some of those basic questions, but you want to be able to talk directly to that provider agency. I think that's one of the first critical things. But you also want to know what kind of services they provide, what level of care, how do they assess somebody. In the state of Illinois, you're supposed to assess based on the American Society of Addiction Medicine, their criteria. Now, I don't expect your listeners to remember that, but the bottom line is there is a standard of care that they have to follow in terms of assessing somebody. And that means it's not a one-size-fits-all. They don't just, you don't pick up the phone and say, everybody gets a residential bed and you're always in for 28 days. That would be a red flag to me. They should talk to you about, well, we're going to assess you. We're going to determine what your best level of care is. We're going to work with you on a treatment plan. We're going to talk about what that plan looks like. And we're also going to talk about when you leave here, what's the recovery plan? Those are kind of the first things that I would look for and I'd be listening for when I'm talking to somebody on the other end of the line.
Yeah, Sarah, thanks for that. And as you've mentioned that, I feel like in this, particularly in the past month or so, maybe just because I've been paying attention to it because I knew we were going to do this segment, I feel like I've seen a lot of commercials on TV. I've heard a lot of ads on the radio saying, if you need help, call these numbers. Dr. Salisbury, Afshar, are those, how do we know if those are legit? Because I've seen also a lot of reporting recently about the fact that these so-called patient brokers may not be the most reputable way for people to get help.
I think that's a great question, and I don't think that we can right now here answer an across-the-board answer that would apply for all of them. I agree with everything that Sarah just stated, that really you want to be able to talk to the actual treatment provider. I will just add there are some increasing resources in the state of Illinois and in Chicago specifically to help identify local resources if that's what someone is looking for. And so two things just to let people know about. So the state of Illinois just launched a helpline specifically for addiction treatment. And I can give you that number now. It's 1-833-2-FIND-HELP, and that's run by the Division of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse here in Illinois. And the city of Chicago is also, we also just launched a website called overcomeopioids.org. Now, just to be clear, this website is more specific for opioid addiction information, but it actually walks through sort of the different levels of care because that's something that many people might not be familiar with, as well as the different medications that are available for opioid addiction treatment. And within the next month, we'll also have a local treatment finder, an online web-based treatment finder there that's specific to Chicago. I apologize because it's not up today, but it is coming very soon, and it will be linked through that website. And so I think it is hard. You know, when you see a commercial, you call the number. It's really hard to know the legitimacy of that site. But I think you do want to make sure that you're able to, as Sarah said, speak to the actual agency that they would be referring you to. And I think for most people, the more realistic option is that you're going to get treatment in your community or at least in your general area. And so, you know, it might behoove you to first look at the state and local resources for finding local help. And then when, you know, and if you're having trouble doing that, also potentially calling your insurance provider and seeing if they can help you identify which programs they might be working with through your own network. Those would be other options that would hopefully provide more accurate local information.
Thanks for that. And Sarah, again, that number, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about that helpline. As Dr. Salisbury, Afshar was just saying, that number, and we'll repeat it a couple of times, but that number is 833-2-FIND-HELP. Again, that's 833-2-FIND-HELP. We are going to have that on our website. We'll tweet it out as well. So it'll be there for you folks. You can always remember to just go to 21stshow.org if you need that number, if you're listening and didn't have a chance to write that down. Sarah, I know sometimes when people call the hotlines that are advertised on TV or they hear on radio, sometimes they direct you to out-of-state providers. Is that another red flag as well? Okay. Sarah?
That is absolutely a red flag. I'm glad you brought that up. I think one of the first red flags you hear is, well, we'll give you a flight. I've heard that numerous times, too often to count.
That sounds really, that doesn't sound like a good idea at all, does it? I mean,
it's one of those, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. When they're advertising the location more than the treatment, oh, you come, we're on the beach, you can play in the sand, you know, some of those things that sound great for a vacation, but not necessarily a treatment provider, that's always a red flag as well. Believe it or not, one of the other things that we're hearing is, don't worry, you can still use while you're in treatment. We have heard that from some of the patient brokers, the middle brokers from out of state. Absolutely, that's a red flag. If anybody says to you, you can come to addiction treatment and don't worry about it, you can still continue to use drugs or alcohol while you're here, that is not a reputable place. And flat out, that is a problem. We have heard all of those things. So, yes, I think what is really important is what was just said. There are good places in your community across the state. And now we do have this hotline, which is great, because the hotline itself is staffed by the Department of Human Services. They have trained individuals that are trained to do a very brief screening, not the full assessment that I talked about. That will happen, you know, within the treatment center, but a screening so that they can at least get an idea of what level of care you would be likely to receive. And from there, they can make some recommendations on what's in your area based on that level of care. And if there's a level of care that you need that's not necessarily right in your backyard, then they can give you other areas within the state of Illinois that have those levels of care, because there are multiple levels of care. It's like I've said many times before, you wouldn't walk into an oncologist's office and want them to say everybody gets chemo without knowing what type of cancer you had and what stage it was. So it's the same thing when we talk about addiction treatment. You need to be assessed and have the right level of care and the right level of treatment.
Dr. Salisbury, Afshar, are you finding that there's still a great need for people to find the right information for treatment? Is it problem information or access or both?
I think it's both. I think one of the other, you know, challenges in this space is that most treatment providers aren't able to provide every level of care. And similarly, for certain substance use disorders, specifically alcohol and opioid use disorder, there are medications that can be used, but there are very few treatment providers that are able to offer all of those options. And so one thing that we see is that patients sometimes find themselves at a treatment program because their neighbor recommended it or they knew someone who went there. And, you know, there will always be an assessment component to sort of make sure that someone qualifies for services. But I think the other thing we really need to try to do a better job at as professionals is make sure that patients understand all of the treatment options and families understand all of the treatment options. And specifically around medication, we know that people who receive access to medication and behavioral supports for opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder have better outcomes in terms of, you know, not continuing to use, the length of time that they continue to be engaged in treatment when they have access to both medication and behavioral support, although they may go to a treatment program that doesn't support the use of medication. So I think that's another really important caveat and thing to consider is to really get as much information as possible when you're thinking about what type of program you want to go to or you might want to encourage a family member to go to. And unfortunately, there still is a lot of stigma, both in the treatment community sometimes as well as in the general population around the use of medication. And so really understanding sort of what are the outcomes and how and why do people some people do better. And that's not to say that every person with, you know, opioid or alcohol use disorder has to be on medication. But I think about it in a very similar way to how we think about treating depression or high blood pressure, that yes, some people are able to manage their depression or their high blood pressure with lifestyle change and a lot of behavioral supports and other things. And some people need medication and other support, behavioral support. And so really thinking through what are the different options and what are the outcomes and what does that individual want to try, and making sure that they understand the differences in those different options and understand, again, in particular, the evidence base behind the use of medication. And then if they are interested in trying medication, going to a location that's able to offer it.
Right. And when Dr. Salisbury Afshar, when we think about medications, particularly regarding opioid addiction, what are we talking about in particular?
Yeah, so there are three medications that are FDA approved to be used for the treatment of opioid use disorder. And the first one is methadone. Methadone's been around for a really long time and has a very strong evidence base because it's been around so long. The second one, and I will just add, methadone is only available in very specific licensed opioid treatment programs is the name of the program. And so the only certain types of facilities are even able or allowed to offer methadone treatment. The second medication is called buprenorphine. The more common name that people often know it by is Suboxone, but the generic name is buprenorphine. This is a medication that can often be prescribed out of an office, but is also increasingly being used in treatment settings. So, you know, a primary care office or a psychiatry office might be able to offer this form of medication. That being said, any provider that's writing a prescription for it does have to have a special license to be able to prescribe it. So not everyone that has prescribing authority can prescribe buprenorphine. And the third medication is naltrexone. And this is typically offered in the form of an injection that lasts for 1 month. And the name that people may be familiar of naltrexone, the trade name is Vivitrol. And so that one is an injection that you get once a month. And while that injection is in your system, if you use opioids on top of it, they essentially don't work. And so naltrexone is actually approved more as a relapse prevention medication as opposed to sort of a maintenance treatment, because the main thing it's doing is blocking those opioid receptors.
Sarah, can I ask about you all represent about 60 service providers across the state with the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. What areas in Illinois do you see as having the greatest need for connecting people to good treatment? Is there a particular parts of the state that you think are more lacking than others?
Well, certainly in our, I think our southern counties, our more rural areas, finding a provider that's right in your backyard sometimes is not possible. But there are providers within those southern counties, western counties. We have them all across the state. But sometimes they're not necessarily within a 10-minute drive, let's say. It really depends on where you live, particularly if you are in a smaller rural county. But there are providers that you can get to. And when the state actually does their licensing, they really try to make sure that there aren't gaps where you can't get within, I want to say it's about within an hour or so to get into a provider. But providers are also doing other things like telemedicine, working in terms of telepsychiatry. If they can try to work maybe with the local hospital, they'll try to collaborate, because they do recognize sometimes even, you know, an hour away is a long trip. So if you really are in one of those farther areas where you don't have somebody right in your backyard, there are ways to work with them. And I would say that you can definitely, you know, call that provider and find out what options they have. Our website, which is ILABH, so it's the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health, ILABH.org, has our members listed by the area of the state. So that's one of the things that we do try to offer for the public is who are available in your area. We have it listed by counties, and then we list out the actual counties that we're talking about so that you can really kind of zero in your area. But also I would say, again, from what the doctor pointed out, which is that helpline, that 1-833-2-FIND-HELP, will also, within the state, they will look for state-licensed providers, which is really critical as well, and they will find out where you live and what's available to you.
Right. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Where you may have to go a little bit farther.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Sarah. We'll have all of this information at our website.
Sure.
Sarah Howe is CEO of the Illinois Association of Behavioral Health. I want to thank also Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar with the Chicago Department of Public Health as the medical director. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up on Sunday, we're going to be talking about the Golden Globes that's happening. It's the award show. We're going to have a spoiler alert also for you, talking about some TV. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. To the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Sunday, some of the biggest names in television and movies come together to see who wins this year's Golden Globes. It's the awards handed down from the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. It's always a fun night of award show viewing, especially since it includes both television and movies. And if you're like me and love TV, you can play along at home and pick the winners. Of course, I'm only an amateur TV critic. Joining us now is a real one. Eric Adams is a TV editor at the AV Club. Hey, Eric, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So remind me how this works. The Golden Globes is the award show with alcohol, correct? That's the distinction from, say, the Emmys or the SAG as award season kicks off.
Yes, exactly. That is perfectly put. It's the award ceremony where everybody gets to be a little chummy because there's champagne on the tables and there's dinner served and it's in the ballroom of the Beverly Hilton and it's not in an auditorium. It's very chatty. It's very casual. And I think that has built a reputation for the Globes for being more of an entertaining award ceremony than they actually are as any sort of accurate barometer for what the SAGs or the Oscars might give awards to. You know, the Hollywood Foreign Press is a mysterious voting body who likes to have celebrities in their ballroom and on their TV show. So they often bend rules to get, you know, say Johnny Depp nominated for The Tourist in a comedy category. All sorts of what we in the biz like to call category fraud going on at the Golden Globes, which I guess would kind of contribute to its reputation as well.
That's funny. I mean, in terms of category fraud, let's get into some of the categories and maybe you can tell me what some of your favorites are and which ones were nominated and which ones you think should have been nominated. Let's start with drama. This is a big category. Let's play a clip from my personal favorite from television, This Is Us.
Do you want to know why we don't come home for the holidays anymore? It's because of you. You're gonna most certainly give Kate a complex about food, and Kevin is gonna think that his only value in life comes from how he looks, and all of that is Fine, all of that I can sort of explain away to the kids, but Randall tries so hard to get you to like him. I've always wondered if the reason that you never bonded with him was because he was adopted, but you've made it alarmingly clear that it's because he's black.
That is a scene from This Is Us, nominated for drama in the Golden Globes. Eric Adams, TV editor of the AV Club, is with us. Eric, do you think this should win? What will win?
I think it's The Handmaid's Tale's year to win. The Hulu adaptation of the Margaret Atwood dystopian novel kind of swept things at the Emmys. It was the very first streaming program to win the best drama Emmy, which was a big milestone. It beat Netflix, who have been competing in that category ever since House of Cards debuted, and are very competitive in the best drama category at the Globes this year. They've got both The Crown, which won the award last year, and Stranger Things is up for that award. But I just think there's a certain relevancy to The Handmaid's Tale that is difficult to deny. And these are also the Hollywood Foreign Press. It's right there in their name. They're the Foreign Press. They are correspondents from publications that are based worldwide. So they often tend to skew toward things that may have a more international appeal. And that's kind of how The Crown got its win last year, I think. And, you know, The Handmaid's Tale coming from a Canadian author, kind of taking a gimlet eye to the way that things are happening in America, I think that may curry favor with the voters of the HFPA, in addition to being just a very solid drama.
Yeah, it's really solid. It is hard to compete, actually, as you mentioned that. It's almost, it seems like a different category to put This Is Us and The Handmaid's Tale in the same category, because they're very, very different shows. What do you think about musical or comedy? There are two first-time nominees in this category, right?
There's two newcomers, and the HFPA loves new comedies. I can just kind of rattle off the top of my head just the last couple of years where they've either given best television series, musical, or comedy to a show that was in its freshman year, say like Brooklyn Nine-Nine a few years ago, or they've given the best actress in a comedy award to a first-time nominee, the star of a show that was in its first season, like Rachel Bloom in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or Jane the Virgin there. And so you've got these two shows, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon and Smilf on Showtime. You know, they're fresh perspectives. Smilf coming from a creator and star, Frankie Shaw, who's kind of like, this is kind of her big breakout thing. And then The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is the first new TV project from Amy Sherman Palladino after she brought Gilmore Girls back for Netflix last year. And I like Mrs. Maisel's chances in this category simply because the HFPA has been very generous to Amazon in recent years.
Eric, so when we look at 10 shows alone in the two categories for drama and comedy, what drama would you have liked to see get better recognition? What got shut out?
I was really disappointed to see Better Call Saul not get recognition in the best drama category. That was a show that was like, I really, really loved its most recent season, and it was very difficult for me to leave it off of my year-end ballot.
It's not in my interest for Hector Salamanca to die at this time.
Who is he to you?
An associate of an associate.
How very specific.
Who is he to you?
We had a disagreement. He threatened my family. I'm not going to let that go.
And this season also had a very tough challenge ahead of itself, where it brought Gus Fring, one of the most popular villains from Breaking Bad, into the Better Call Saul fold. And it seemed like maybe that figure, that threat that he poses, may overshadow everything that Better Call Saul had built up in its first few seasons. But it really just, it got even better this year. At the very least, Bob Odenkirk is represented in the best actor categories. So that's that is nice. And in terms of comedies, my favorite show of last year arguably my favorite show on TV right now, The Good Place, completely shut out. I find it hard to argue with some of these selections. I don't think Will and Grace is really up to the standards that it set when it was in its prime.
And did Will and Grace 15, get nominated?
20 years ago.
Yeah, so Will and Grace did get nominated.
Yeah, Will and Grace did get nominated.
Oh, yeah. So, I didn't. And, I mean, I'm going to make a lot of enemies here. I was never a fan of it, and I watched the first, and I didn't even make it through the whole first new episode. We actually have a clip, though, from The Good Place, which I haven't seen. Let's play a little bit of that.
Oh, my God. 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 Oh, my God.
This is the bad place. I fucking knew it. And clam chowder is disgusting. It's just hot ocean milk with dead animal croutons.
Okay, well, what do we do? Panic, freak? I usually panic, but I am happy to freak.
We have to stay cool, as my mom always used to say. If a cop handcuffs you to a bike rack, there's always something you can gnaw through.
Your mom always said that?
That's from The Good Place. Remind us, Eric, the premise of what The Good Place is.
Well, your viewers who haven't watched the show may want to have plugged their ears before that clip is played, because that kind of gives a huge spoiler for the first season and was kind of like a big part of the appeal at the end of that first season. Basically, Kristen Bell is playing this character, Eleanor Shellstrop, who she describes herself as a medium person. When she was alive, she was neither a great person nor was she a very bad, evil person. But after she dies under comically tragic circumstances, she finds herself in the good place, which is this heavenly realm where she is told by the architect of the good place, played by Ted Danson, that the very, very best of humanity are allowed into this afterlife. And when you're living, you get this point accumulation that counts up and down for every good and bad deed. And the very, very, very best scores get you into this this idyllic place. And so the first season is very much about Eleanor kind of trying to navigate the fact that she's not supposed to be there and finding out new clues and new information about the good place that leads her to believe that things may not be exactly as they seem.
Wow. Okay, well, we did spoiler, but oh well. I guess it's been 2 years since the second season, right? Last question for you, Eric. Going back to some of your favorites from 2017, a lot of us are spending time indoors, binge-watching TV this January for both lots of – nobody really wants to leave their houses with this cold weather. What show got overlooked? What do you think we should binge for folks who are big TV fans, maybe Golden Globes aside or not? What should – people be looking at or maybe revisiting?
Well, you know, the entire first season of The Good Place is on Netflix, and even though
we just ruined it, you should watch it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even though there was that spoiler in there, I think that clip is a perfect example of what that show does so well, you know, describing clam chowder as hot ocean milk with bugs, or that reaction from William Jackson Harper, who plays Chidi, who is Eleanor's Good Place assigned soulmate. He, you know, she says, my mother always said this, and says something ridiculous. And he says, your mother always said that? Just like, it's just so perfectly written and hilariously acted. Another show that you can binge easily in about 5 hours is Glow, the Netflix original comedy based on the gorgeous ladies of wrestling.
Yeah, I have to say, I didn't even get through. This is another one. Maybe I'm being picky. I didn't get through the first episode of that. I started watching and I thought, how do you want to talk me into this?
Well, I mean, the thing that just sells me about Glow is that both it's such a compelling lead performance by Alison Brie.
I do like her.
She's been so good in supporting roles on Community and Mad Men. And here she just kind of really gets to harness this weird sort of energy she has. It's a very complex character for her to play, and I love seeing that. And also, as someone who's not even remotely a fan of professional wrestling, the wrestling in Glow is really good.
So do I grab on to a specific body part?
Sort of grab everything and fall backwards.
You're not going to drop me, right?
No, I swear. Got you. If you miss, my body will break the fall. I'll take the hit.
Okay.
How'd that look?
So great.
And we really just have just about a minute left, but looking forward to this year. Any new shows you're excited about?
I cannot believe how excited I am about the new X-Files. I was ready to completely write that show off after its 10th season, and I was ready to write it off after the season premiere that came out on January 3rd. But the next four episodes kind of get back into what that show was good at in its prime, which are just these very strange, compelling supernatural mysteries anchored by the chemistry between David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson.
So if you missed the 10th season, which I did because I started it and I thought it's another one that I didn't finish. Can you just hop back in, especially if you watched the previous eight or nine seasons of The X-Files?
Oh, absolutely. And they do something that is both infuriating and relieving in this week's premiere that totally makes it so that most of the events of season 10 didn't really matter.
Ah, okay, well, good. It's on my DVR. All right. Thanks so much. The Golden Globes are this Sunday. We got a preview, at least from the TV side, with Eric Adams. He's the TV editor of AV Club. Eric, thanks for joining us and talking TV for a little. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was an absolute delight.
Before we end our first week of broadcasts, we wanted to say a special thanks to one of our producers. Christine Herman is a name you hear at the end of our credits, or you did up until last year at least, when she left us for maternity leave. You all hear my voice every day, but there are so many more hardworking people who make this show happen. And Christine was one of our very first producers and responsible for our award-winning coverage of the 2016 election night. Much of our science and health coverage, whether it's been Neil deGrasse Tyson or the latest engineering company to come out of the University of Illinois, as well as how residents throughout the state have been affected by the budget impasse. So we say thanks to her and goodbye, and she's not going too far. She's moved into the WILL newsroom as a reporter. In fact, you may have heard her very first national story that aired on All Things Considered earlier this week.
And across the Midwest, there are lots of people today who need help. As an unusually long stretch of brutally cold sub-zero temperatures, blamed for at least a dozen deaths, continues to stick around. For NPR News, I'm Christine Herman in Champaign, Illinois.
So look out for that voice, and from all of us at the 21st, thanks to Christine. We're produced by Robin Lynn and Alan Montecilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft, Jerry Moorfield, and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.